Hey everybody, we're the Con Artists. We're back for another episode. This time we're going to be talking about Petite Princess Yuusi. This is a really, really fun show, so I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this. So, disclaimer, just like the last episode, there are minor spoilers in this podcast for Petite Princess Yuusi. So if you're super sensitive to spoilers, you might want to save this podcast for after you have watched the show. Alright, so what's Petite Princess Yuusi about? Yuusi is a 17-year-old in a 10-year-old's body. She ends up at a school where she learns that she, along with four other girls who have her same predicament, are Platinum Princess candidates. Only one of them can be chosen, and they must power up the Eternal Tiara in order to be granted a wish. So, this show is a good time. I had a genuinely good time watching this. So, Scott, weirdly enough, you're the one who I think suggested we all watch this together.
Yeah, I had found it somewhere back in the day, and I don't even know why I started watching it, and it turned out to be just charming, I guess is a good word. So yeah, I ended up saying, hey, we should all watch this, and we did.
All right, cool stuff. So, Dan, you want to take us through some of the world we get introduced to? Because there's a lot of world jumping in this show. I think it's almost like the heart and soul of what we're going to go through with these characters.
That's true. The show itself takes place across a number of different realms, most of them fairly, I guess, standard magical realms from various different backgrounds. And for the most part, it's in the generic kind of fantasy human world. That's where we start out. That's where we spend the bulk of our time. But we also get at least one or two episodes dedicated to each of the other worlds. There's the world of the demons, the underworld, sort of like hell, but there's a bit of a twist. The world of the angels, heaven, so to speak, which is kind of crazy in its own way that I won't spoil for now. There's the world of spirits or ghosts, which I think we only see once, but it's kind of a haunted house sort of deal. Pretty neat. And you also have the fairy realm, which is a big sort of forest, open meadow, kind of very, fairy tale, land with no real human inhabitants. But they do spend a lot of time hopping between each of these worlds on various quests and objectives, trying to, get all of these girls together and accomplish the various goals that they set out to accomplish in order to, as you said, sort of power up the tiara and prove their worth as Platinum Princess candidates.
Yeah, no, these are pretty much just like fun places to go. There's no consideration that, people that die in the human world go to heaven or hell or become ghosts. Like, they all just sort of have their own inhabitants of those realms rather than trying to set up anything more complicated.
Yeah, that's true. The worlds are pretty easy to understand. They're almost like zones or something that you can go enter from anywhere. All right, so Brendan, you want to take us through the five girls that I mentioned? I mean, obviously the show is called Petite Princess Yuusi, so Yuusi being our human character is the main character, and she's our Genki girl, but do you want to take us through the other four?
Well, the first other character that Yuusi comes across after she joins the, or even before, actually, she joins the Princess Academy is a girl named Kokolu. And she's sort of a meek girl, has little glasses, doesn't want to, cause any trouble. And they get along well. They become besties. And it's not long, though, before Yuusi encounters her foil, the Demon Princess Glenda, with elegant beauty and fantastic magic, who's always up in her face about, being better than Yuusi, being the dominant Platinum Princess candidate. It's only much later that we learn that Kokolu was also Platinum Princess candidate, which she never mentioned just because she doesn't want to stir things up. Shortly thereafter, we meet Elmina, the Princess of the Heavens, who also serves as a foil for Glenda, as
So true.
being aloof and proper, like, in contrast to Glenda's brash personality. And it's not until the second half of the show where we get around to meeting the fairy princess Beth, who is also confrontational for reasons.
That's true. We'll be talking about those a little later. Beth is the most difficult of the characters. But like we said, we'll get to her later in the discussion. All right, so every character, I should say every Platinum Princess, gets a steward who helps her do things. These guys were mostly just there for comic relief and, I think, help when help required it. They could do stuff that kind of acted as plot devices. I don't know that we want to talk about those guys too much, but UC had Cube, who appeared to be a demon. Glenda had...
He was a traitor.
Yes, he's a traitor demon. All right, thank you, Brendan. Then Glenda had Gaga, this big, lanky thing that was always desperately trying to serve her and could morph into a little demon cat with wings. So adorable.
By far the best steward.
Yeah, by far.
He is funny to watch.
Yeah, he's great. Elmina got Balazan, I believe it's pronounced.
Yeah, Balazan.
Balazan, this big, hulking robot. That,
yeah, Heaven has high technology for some reason, so Balazan's a big robot dude.
Yeah, he's a big robot who talks with, you know, this adorable little robotic voice. And they're kind of cute, because Elmina will just sit on his shoulder while he wheels around like a giant tank. Kokolu gets Chawu, who is... Chawu is such a contrast to her. We'll be talking later about some of the episodes, but I do have to spoil. In one of them, they're all afraid because they have to model for a painter. And Chawu, to try and help Kokolu out because she's so nervous about it, transforms into Kokolu herself and is standing there in this, like, sexy pose, like, "Hello, Mr. Artist. I'm Kokolu." And the real Kokolu comes out and is like, "Seriously, what are you even doing?
Do you even know me?"
Yes.
Yeah, Chawu tends to be really...
I adore that.
Tries to push Kokolu into doing stuff, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Beth gets Bell, who we will... Oh, goodness. We will affectionately call Desu, because she finishes all of her sentences with Desu.
And also has the most piercing voice in the entire show.
Oh, yeah. She's so weird.
Yeah, like, thank goodness... Like, it's a good thing for Chawu that Bell exists, because Chawu's kind of annoying, but Bell blows him out of the water.
Absolutely.
So. Yeah.
Fortunately, the stewards are mostly secondary characters who, you know, as you said, Sue, sort of provide assistance where needed, especially early on. Cube provides a lot of almost literal plot devices to help Yuci along on her various tasks and quests and so forth. And they do even get eventually one episode more or less dedicated to them, but overall, they're relegated to kind of side characters and comic relief. They don't overstay their welcome, which is good, because they're kind of one-trick ponies, but they're enjoyable to watch while they're there.
They certainly are, and I have to admit that I haven't seen plot devices that have to pay money to do what they have to do. Like, poor Cube has to toss money into this, what looks like an alchemaic circle. I guess it's the demon world, to get what he needs. You know, he says some sort of chanting, and then out of the circle comes whatever the heck he needs for the moment. So, that was cute and creative, and... You know, kind of like Scott was saying in the beginning, it adds to the charm that this show has. All right, so let's start talking about the show itself. We mentioned the idea of Platinum Princess candidates. And so when the girls are brought to Princess Academy, they're meant to be learning all these things like magic and etiquette and all that stuff. Really, what this gets relegated to is the girls need to go out and do community service. Like, that's really the crux of a lot of the plots. Like, in this week's episode... Yuci and Kokolu have to take care of children. And then, you know, Kokolu gets this adorable baby, and Yuci gets this giant marshmallow puff thing that can split into 10 puffs. And the whole episode is just her chasing the puffs around the town. You know, so a lot of the episodes are like that. But I think I had more fun than I probably should have had, just because it's almost like the show knows it's goofing around. I know in one of the episodes there's a library where she and another character we'll talk about later, Yuci and another character, get locked in the library, and all the other characters standing around, they're like, "Where's Yuci?" And Elmina's wearing these glasses that have that anime glint to them that look like she's evil, and she just, like, flicks her glasses, and all the other characters flick their respective glasses, and it's like, wait a minute, what? Kukulu had glasses, but Glenda, where did you even get those glasses? Like, what is this episode? They're all just trying to look like librarians. It's really hilarious.
Which actually leads into another neat thing that they get. As Platinum Princess candidates, they're kind of the top of the class, so to speak. Maybe not academically, but they're really the rest of the academy as a whole is just for the otherwise normal daughters of the aristocracy to learn etiquette, to learn leadership, to learn all of these things. But as this sort of special class, Yusi and her companions are, you know, they're the actual platinum princess candidates. They're the big deal. And one of the things they get are these little baubles, these little amulets, which, from an early stage, allow them to change their clothes into whatever is appropriate for the various jobs that they're doing. Like, they go to a bakery, and then they're in these little cute chef's outfits. Then, in the library, they all, you know, they have these librarian outfits, which are actually pretty cool, but they all... I think that's where Glenda gets the glasses. It's just a part of the librarian.
It's part of the
uniform.
Librarian's outfit. Yeah, you're yeah. right. And it's quite funny to watch the show kind of poke fun at almost itself.
Yeah, no, and if that sounds like it's filler, I mean, yeah, it absolutely is. You know, any episode where there isn't plot happening, they're pretty much going somewhere, getting dressed up to do farming or whatever, and then doing it. I think there's even an episode where they dress up as nuns, honestly.
Yes, there is an episode where they end up in a church.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as filler goes, this is pretty good filler, honestly. And that's because it's the interactions between the characters that are really carrying the show more than what they're doing. And the show does a very good job of that.
Right, so we mentioned the show is pretty episodic, but there is this underlying current throughout the show, which is powering up the tiara. And, Queen Ursel, the queen of the actual country of Ursel in this show, don't ask me how that works, she is the principal of the Princess Academy. Don't ask me how it works. And she is tells the girls that they need to, you know, use their heart, basically, to collect these crystal flowers, which will help power up the tiara. And every time they get one, like they do something in one of the filler episodes that gets one, there's this almost sort of ominous scene where Queen Ursel is placing the crystal flowers at what appears to be a large gate of some sort. So there's this underlying current that powering up the tiara is going to do something big and plot related.
We are slowly getting there, but it's a fun ride.
Yeah, it's really all about the ride and all about the characters interacting, and like we stated, every girl who's part of the Platinum Princess candidacy seems to be a 17-year-old stuck in a 10-year-old's body. So this becomes sort of a plot point later on, and I really like that they never went into creep territory with that idea. Like, I guess the other girls sort of mention it, meaning the other characters who are not Princess or Platinum Princess candidates sort of mention it, and they think it's weird, but it doesn't come up a whole lot since those five girls are the ones we normally focus on, and it isn't used for, I don't even know how to phrase it, but a purpose that would be unsavory, let's go with that, with like a young body with a more mature mind put in there. I mean, there's a little bit of romance going on, but it's never in creep territory. And I think I appreciated that, especially out of a Gainax show, because if anyone's familiar with Gainax shows...
Surprisingly, it is a Gainax show.
Yes, it is a Gainax show. That's what I mean. So if anyone's familiar with Gainax shows, they're pretty hard on the fan service.
Looking at you, Gurren Lagann.
Yes. Yes, and Die Buster.
And
the Gainax bounce existed a lot longer ago than that.
That's true.
So yeah, I mean, not only is there a lack of sort of creeper territory with the young bodies thing, I mean, there's also just generally a lack of fan service in the show as a whole. I mean, there's no panty shots or anything like that. They really kept it clean, which is, I don't even know how they managed it. That's just not their thing, but they did
right.
it. Right. More power to them.
Good on them.
It's true.
Some other kind of neat things about the show is that while the focus is very strongly on the Platinum Princess candidates and all of the stuff that they do, the world is actually fairly well developed. I know we said that earlier, you know, the various realms are just sort of kind of an amusement park sort of deal where you come in, you visit, you accomplish whatever it is, and then you leave. There's no politicking between them, no bigger things behind it. But I also like that they do manage to slide in neat little touches here and there. Like, magic in the human world is fairly commonplace, but it's not, you know, it's... There's not a lot of people, there's no wizards running around casting fireballs or, you know, lifting castles and towers into the sky for the most part. There's just little touches. Like, at one point, you see a girl in a little witch hat walking around lighting street lamps at night. They talk about, you know, there's an alchemy shop that they have to work at one point, which sells, you know, various potions and powders and so on. So it's just... Magic and a lot of the fantasy stuff is integrated nicely into the world without, you know, them making a big fuss about it. And I just appreciated that. It's just a nice touch of world building for something that really, for the rest of the show, is kind of in the background. They cared enough that even though this wasn't the focus, they wanted it to all make sense and mesh well.
I feel like there was one wizard who was running around casting fireballs, but he got wrecked by a gunbard in the prologue.
Oh yeah, that did happen.
There was the one wizard with the fireballs.
Speaking of gunbard, he actually adds some seriousness to the show. So gunbard is the hero from long ago who put together the Eternal Tiara for reasons we're not going to spoil, and he now lives in the woods, away from everybody else. He keeps to himself, and he finds Yusi in the woods during one of his exploits, and he takes her as his daughter, and he is the most adorable dad ever, but his relationship with Queen Ursel is actually really tragic. It's revealed very late. We're talking episode 20, I believe, is where his backstory comes out, and it's really heartbreaking, and the show doesn't remedy that. For a show that is cute and fluffy, you'd think something happy would come out of that idea that I'm not going to spoil any more than I probably already have, but it's very sad, and it never fixes itself. It is what it is, and the show sticks to its guns on that, and there's some other serious stuff, too.
Yeah, like the king of the heavens, I guess God, more or less, who's also Elmina's father, is... just the biggest jerk.
He really is.
In the whole show. Like, he demands absolute perfection from Elmina and everyone else in heaven, pretty much. And nothing she can do is ever good enough. And her relationship with her father comes up several times over the course of the show. And, I mean, there's a little improvement, but it doesn't get too much better. So, there is serious stuff in the show. Yeah. And they do, I don't know, it's to its credit that they have it there.
Yeah, there's no sudden moments of, you know, revelation where everyone's all of a sudden now all buddy-buddy or all happy about these things. It's just like, this bed has been made, and you're going to lie in it, and you know, incremental improvement is the best you can hope for. But it does lend, you know, it lends a bit of gravitas to an otherwise very lighthearted show without, you know, without going full-on into grim and gritty territory.
I agree, yeah.
Right, it just seems to make the characters, you know, they feel more like real people, which is good, because, you know, in a show this fluffy, you gotta have something to flesh them out a little bit.
That's right, and speaking of that, actually, every girl identifies with her father in some way. So we talked about Elmina, and poor Elmina is just desperately trying to please her perfectionist father. But, you know, you've got Yusi, who sometimes adores her dad, but has that teenager, like, dad, seriously, like, don't hug me in public. Dad!
Because he's pretty doting.
He is the doting.
Dad, stop making 12-course meals for me.
Oh my gosh.
Where am I going to put all that?
Yeah.
Where am I going to put all that? Also, like, we keep celebrating my birthday, but I never get any physically older, which troubles me, so I'm not really happy about that. And he's like, but we love your birthday!
Yeah. It's the best!
She's like, I know.
Yes.
You've also got, Kokolu doesn't really have much of a relationship with her father because her father doesn't really show up. Much like Kokolu, he doesn't have a lot of presence. He's important in the spirit world, and you never actually see him. You just see a floating book that he's holding at one point.
Yeah, like Kokolu's visible, but most ghost people are actually invisible to everyone else without some kind of special magic to see them. So we never even see the guy.
Yeah,
I mean, we know he's around, but that's about
right.
And then there's Glenda's father.
Glenda, yeah!
Wow. So it's in stark contrast to the King of the Heavens. Glenda's father is, a mixture of incredibly doting, like even more so than Gunbard, and also, I don't know, just likes to watch what she's doing from afar and tape all his favorite moments. So like picture the dad who always has the video camcorder with him. And that's the demon lord there.
Yeah, mm. Poor Glenda. She's just like, she even more so than Yusi, she's like, Dad, seriously, just go away. At one point, actually that library episode where Yusi ends up somewhere with this character named Ark, who we'll talk about later, and all the other girls are like, wait, where have you been this whole time? Where have you been this whole time? And she's like, oh, look, it's Glenda's dad. And Glenda's like, where? Where? Oh, jeez. Where? No! And then she runs away. Yusi runs away. Like, it's that bad. So it's that kind of relationship with her dad. Actually, her wish is to, I think, bring her family back together, because her mother left her father because he's that much of an oaf, which is quite sad.
Brendan, do you actually want to elaborate a little more on just how we talked about the relationship with the fathers, but what about the mothers in this show?
Well, really, Glenda's mother is the only mother that is ever referenced in any way. And also, previously I referred to Cube as a traitor. We're not really sure what he did, but the only reason that he is considered to be a traitor by some of the other demons is that Glenda's mother, for some reason, banished him from the demon world. He seems like a nice enough kid.
Maybe that's the problem.
Glenda's mother's apparently serious business in the demon world.
Right.
Well, she's the reason the demon world's feared, because the demon king is such a softy that, like, there's no way he's going to hold it together.
But what about the rest of them?
Well, Yusi has no biological parents to speak of.
Fair.
And
I don't think we ever hear about Elmina's.
No, like we seriously, there's no reference to any of the other characters.
Yeah, I don't think anyone ever even talks about them. I mean, the only person we haven't mentioned yet is Beth's father, the Fairy King, who's just kind of manifests as a giant tree. I mean, she can kind of talk with him for real, like sort of spiritually visit him, but most of the time he's a giant tree, so he's also not really
somewhat distant.
He's somewhat distant. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
But, it's an interesting, like, the whole show does spend a significant amount of time exploring the relationship between these children who are, in fact, teenagers and their parents and all of the, you know, all the weirdness in between, you know, between the doting and the, the natural kind of rebellion from, not wanting to be under your father's or your parents' wings for too long. Wanting to kind of strike out on your own definitely comes up. And, you know, and at the same time, in Elmina's case, you know, wanting their approval. There's a lot of good meat to the show in the episodes where they deal with that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So we've talked quite a bit about the characters, and I want to get to the fun part of this. I want everybody to have their chance to talk about what we really loved about the show. So I adore Glenda for the first part. I mean, the first time you meet her in episode 2, and she's like, oh yeah, I'm princess of the demon world. I possess elegant beauty and fantastic magic. Like, there's this way she says it that it's just hilarious. And she does it actually so often that I think at one point she's talking to Chawu, who's Kokolu's steward, and he's like, you know, I'm really tired of hearing elegant beauty and fantastic magic. Just throw it out there.
And she drops those adjectives in English.
Oh yeah, just to emphasize them all
right,
the more.
Right, so if you're listening to it in Japanese, it'll be like, elegant, the rest is Japanese, fantastic! And you're like, thank you. Thank you, Glenda.
Thank you, Glenda.
Every time. All the time. But I think the characters really play off of each other in the best way. Like, when you meet Yusi and Glenda together, they are, of course, the ultimate rivals who you know are going to become biffles by the end of the show, if you've watched anything remotely like this. Brendan described how Kokolu is the very gentle one, and, you know, she just follows along with the group, and she provides that gentle balance where there's no conflict involved. Elmina shows up, and she just rails on Glenda. Brendan, I'm going to give you the chance to talk about that. And it's just hilarious. At a certain point, you're like, Elmina, jeez, what is wrong with you? And then Beth. We'll discuss Beth later, because Beth is her own special problem. Brendan, why don't you talk a little bit about Elmina's harshness, because, man, it's bad.
Elmina is the queen of passive aggression.
Oh.
Yes.
For most of the early interactions, like she keeps deflecting Glenda's aggression to other characters, like without even acknowledging, sort of like barely acknowledging that it's even happening.
Yeah, that's true. When she first appears, actually, when Elmina first appears, Glenda stands up and she's like, "Aha, Princess of Heaven, you're finally here to settle the dispute between heaven and the demon world." And Elmina's like, "Teacher, I think that girl's talking to you." And she's like, "Do not deflect me, woman! I am here to challenge you!" And yeah, that starts an endless trail of, "I'm ignoring you. I'm still ignoring you."
And once the ignoring finally ends, like, Glenda will say something and Elmina will just offhandedly put her down super hard.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty bad. Oh.
So Elmina's kind of like the queen of the sick burn, but yeah, it's very passive-aggressive. Whereas Glenda and Yussi tend to fight head-to-head. Like,
sometimes
say
literally.
Something mean. Yeah, sometimes literally, like, pushing their head up against each other. But, like, Glenda will say something mean, and Yussi will just be like, "Oh, I'm not taking that from you." And they just get into these great fights. They're a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty solid. But since the episodes are so episodic in nature, you can almost pick some of your favorites and just have a good time. So we gotta talk about episode 7, which I think we've collectively dubbed the Gainax episode. They end up in the demon world, because so it turns out that the pieces of the tiara that they're supposed to be gathering to help power it up,
the crystal flowers.
Yes, the crystal flowers are all in a different world every time. So when they have to go to the demon world to collect that one, it's pretty much all up to Glenda, because she rolls in there and her people are like, "Princess Glenda, we've all been turned into cats and dogs." And it's like, oh, you know this episode is going to be crazy. And it turns out it's this crazed cat king and this thing, and Glenda transforms into this skin-tight suit with tiny red wings and is flying around on this broom at ridiculous angles. Things are blowing up, and it's the craziest episode by far.
They managed a missile swarm in a fantasy series. We won't tell you the details. Let's just say that, yeah, this is the episode where the animators were given a very free leash.
It's very interesting to note, I think, that the miniature mecha that the Kate Sith, like, cat creature, like, rides around in is very, shall we say, preminiscent of the Gonmen, which populate Gurren Lagann.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you could definitely see a lot of early influence on what would become Gurren Lagann in this episode. Like, from the way characters move, which is extremely fluid, to the way explosions look, to this, you know, this crazy mech thing he's got.
There's even a point where Glenda transforms her outfit into this weird thing with, like, eyes and teeth on it. It's some sort of costume, but it's so clearly it would very obviously come up if you were ever to look back on it from more recent stuff like Gurren Lagann, or even more so from Kill la Kill. It's so readily apparent that these guys were leading up to these sorts of things that it's just fun to look back and see, not necessarily where these things came from, because they could have been inspired by anything, just to show that this isn't Gainax's first rodeo on this stuff. They already cut their teeth a few years back.
Right, and it's interesting to find it here in all places. I mean, most of the animation's fairly, you know, if it's good animation, but it's fairly cut and dry. This episode, they just go over the top. It's completely different from any other episode.
Yeah.
Except maybe one of the later episodes where they actually go into sort of Magical Girl battle mode, but it's like it's like halfway between Magical Girl fight and sort of Record of Lodoss War-esque battle. It's pretty great. Don't want to give too many spoilers, but that, I don't even remember which number it is, but
I think it's like 22 or 3 or something. It's pretty late.
Yeah, it's leading into the finale, and it is easily my favorite episode. I love the Gainax episode, don't get me wrong, but that one just gets me right where I find that wonderful peak of enjoyment of, you know, crazy action, high stakes, and all of these characters that you have actually come to, you know, be attached to and, you know, understand to a degree, all have to band together to overcome something so much bigger than all of them. And it doesn't disappoint.
Yep. And fantastic magical power.
Oh, of course.
And elegant beauty. Yes. So I really love 12. So in episode 12, they have to go to the Heaven World. And Heaven's World is like a series of puzzles to get to the top. So they end up there in the first round, you know, this robot comes out. Like Scott was saying, it's all very mechanical. And this robot comes, and I think Dan, you had pointed out that he's in the Shinto, Japanese Shinto outfit. And he's like, oh, to reach the top, you need to, complete all these special tasks. And the first one is this ridiculous, I can't call it a Rubik's Cube. It's like a Rubik's diamond.
It's like an octahedron, yeah, or something.
This Rubik's diamond that they're supposed to solve. And of course, nobody has any idea what's going on. Elmina solves it in all of 0.0 seconds. And she's like, oh, yeah, all right, moving on. And they just keep having to do these more and more ridiculous challenges. One of them is like the Fighters Challenge, where they end up in some sort of battle arena. And, you know, nobody can lift any of the weapons they're supposed to be using. It's like, what is this? It's riotous. And I had a great time with that. Because it's just enough wacky that I was having a great time, not too much over the top. But the best part is it ends with the Dance Dance Revolution Challenge, where the Elmina has to dance in a special pattern that lights up the floor in order to get the last task to appear. And she just can't do it because she has this traumatic memory of being a little girl doing, I guess, what looked like ballet for...
No, it's the same dance.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
you're right. So she has to do this dance when she was a child for her father and the members of, I guess, Heaven's Court. And she ends up freaking out because they all look so stoic, and she ends up falling. And she has this horrible memory of her father just walking away from her down one of those endless Japanese corridors. And she's like, Father, why? I'll do it right this time. I will. And he's like, Elmina, don't do pointless things. You must be perfect all the time. That's when she really developed her I will never fail ever mentality that I think was really sort of damaging to her as a person. But she can't seem to complete this dance because of the memory. And all the girls are like, no, Elmina, we'll totally help you. And then all of them have to do the dance in synchronization in order to get this thing to appear. And I'm like, yes! Yes, this is the culmination. Like, it's ultimate biffledom saves the day is what it is.
It's true. Like, you got a cue, like, the, you know, you got a cue that there's, like, a montage sequence. There's music going. Then there's synchronized dance. It was like, all right, this is pretty great.
Yeah. This is pretty great.
Everyone dance like you want to win.
Yes, dance like you want to win.
it was great.
Yeah, speaking of Morrigan X, hello, Evangelion.
Yeah really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a really fun episode.
The Many Adventures of Gunbard.
Oh, man.
Well,
that's true.
Many might be a bit of a stretch, because there's only one episode that of which a small portion is dedicated to his adventures, but man, are they awesome.
Yeah, sort of like he's well known across the kingdom as a hero, and this was in one of the later episodes, they kind of give you some of the scenes of the things he went through, you know, to become a hero, and boy, it looks really exciting. Like, if there's any complaint I could levy against the show, it would be, can we get a spinoff with Gunbard in it?
There isn't enough Gunbard.
I want to watch the Gunbard show. And, like, you know, it's definitely a big change. I mean, most of the time, he's just the nicest dad ever, which is he's a good character there, too. But you get to see the other side of him before he really found Yusi and started bringing her up, and it's pretty cool.
And he's not, you know, he's not the usual tropey champion of justice. He's a guy who wants to do right by his kingdom, and specifically by then Princess Ursel, later Queen Ursel. But we're not going to ruin too much of it, but their relationship was a rocky road for various reasons. But yeah, just watching his adventures and when he is confronted about them by another character, he gets somewhat distant about it. He's up until this point, you've only seen him being, you know, really supportive, really doting, and occasionally get a bit, you know, I won't say stern, but, you know, he has these kind of moments of quiet strength. But in these situations, he pretty much locks down, and you can see that there's a certain degree of stoicism behind it all.
Yeah, more depth to a character that you didn't really think was going to get depth, but he did.
Yep, I mean, that touches back to some of the more touching and more serious scenes that Yusi has to offer. There's, in addition to the dance, there's also a karaoke revolution episode. I dubbed it the karaoke revolution episode.
Oh, yeah.
I think this episode's funny because it touches... So by this point, Ark, who is this male... He's actually the prince of the realm, so he's Ursel's son. And he and Yusi kind of have a thing going, and they've been running into each other almost by accident through a good chunk of the show, and the other girls have noticed, and so the girls have to participate in some sort of event where they sing together, and they come together and they can't really decide on this song, and at one point it ends in this huge yelling match on the staircase where both Elmina and Glenda are like, look, you know what? Like, why do you even want to hang out with us? Why don't you just go hang out with Ark, the love of your life? And she's like, why do you guys keep doing this to me? You know what? And then she just shuts down and she's like, you know what? I forget it. I'm not gonna even try with you guys. And she runs off and she's really unhappy. And then all the other girls accidentally end up at her house later. Wink, wink, accidental, because they're all biffles. And they all make up, and then they sing the rival song. Like, if you listen to it, they're all just like, we're rivals, and we will fight each other as the best rivals, but we're also friends and rivals. I'm like, this song is amazing. Thank goodness for this song. But it's...
How did you put it, Brendan?
The lyrics are the point of the episode.
That was the one. It's
really not entirely clear whether they've been, like... Whether they knew that that's what they were singing the entire time, or if it's supposed to be diegetic or something. That happens a lot in whenever songs come up in shows like this.
Point fair.
That's true. But it was, and actually at that point, like when the coordinated dance episode, there was still just the four of them. They didn't have Beth yet. But like this, the singing episode is really the first time that Beth participated as a member of the team, which gives us a good segue into to talk about Beth a little bit. Like, she's the fifth candidate princess, the fairy one, but she does not join the team for an incredibly long time.
Oh my gosh, right? Yeah. She swoops in and saves Kukulu at one point, and they're like, who are you, mysterious girl? And then she's sort of traitorous, because I think in the episode she appears, she's like manipulating the forest to get them, or eliminate all the other candidates, because she desperately wants her wish to be granted. She's like, all right, I'll just eliminate all the other candidates, so I'm the only one picked. And you're like, Beth, come on, don't be like that. And you think after that, she's just going to join in with the group. And no, it's really not like that. Like, Beth will show up every once in a while, and she's more of an on-screen character now. But she's definitely not part of the team. And I think numerous times we were sitting there going, Beth, be a character already.
Right, because, like, basically Kokolu, the quietest, shyest one, is the one who really tries to befriend Beth, who's the brash, like... you know, kind of wants to fight everyone type of person. So, I mean, their friendship's kind of fun to watch. But so many times, you know, Koku will be like, won't you join us? And Beth will be like, psh, no, not today. I'm like, come on,
yeah,
Beth,
don't be like that.
So, eventually, of course, she does join, but it's pretty late in the show, which is too bad. We still do get some time with her. And, well, her and her dumb hat.
Oh my god, her helmet, you mean?
It is so
her
dumb.
Helmet?
It's like a framework of a helmet. Like, it's only the two cross pieces. There's nothing between them. So her hair comes out through it, but it looks so dumb. Like, you got to find a picture of it, folks, who are listening to this.
Yeah. Yeah, her...
It's
her
pretty silly.
Helmet hat thing is absurd.
It's got ear guards.
It does have ear guards.
It does have, like, big, like, Canadian hat flaps that come down to the sides.
Thank goodness for that.
It does serve a purpose. But if its purpose is to be head protection or even a useful hat, it's definitely failing at that.
Yes. All right, so I alluded to or talked about Ark a lot. I think it's time we talk about him, even though he almost wasn't a necessary character. So as a side plot, Yusi was saved in the woods one day by a mysterious prince.
Like you do.
Yes.
Like when she was very small, you know, the kind of classic, you know, thing from your childhood that's going to determine what you want to be when you grow up.
Right. And so she's like, oh, I want to find this prince because he is the man of my dreams and I want to say thank you. And, you know, of course, as a young girl, like, I kind of have a crush on him. And she runs into Ark, who is kind of a tool, through a good chunk of the show. In fact, I believe he just refers to her as Forehead through a good chunk of the show.
She does have a massive forehead.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, she could definitely forge a laser beam off of that thing. And so, you know, he's not anything like her prince at all, but she kind of has a thing for him because he's a bad boy. And it turns out that he is, in fact, that character. And he has this whole sort of side plot where he's actually the one who confronts Gunbard later about various details of his life. And he does save Yusi and other characters at certain points. And eventually he's a big part of the Ender plot.
What's his face there? Like the... I can't read the guy's name now. You know, Midnight Rose guy?
Oh, the tuxedo mask of Abyssa.
He's kind of like a tuxedo mask, but he doesn't overdo it. Thankfully.
No, in the end of things, while he does definitely save her from physical danger a lot of the time, Yusi is the one who determines her own destiny. It may seem now and again like she's getting upstaged, but that's mainly because he's a fully grown person who can use a sword, and when you're confronted by a giant wolf beast or something, that's sort of what you need. You can't really rely on a girl in a 10-year-old body, no matter how plucky she is, to get by something like that.
So much pluck.
That's true. There's a realism there, I agree. But he was almost an unnecessary character. Like, he has a huge piece, I don't even really want to call it huge, like he gets sick or something at the end of the show, and that pushes Yusi's ambitions to be the Platinum Princess pretty hard.
But it's not like she didn't have those before.
It was just for a different reason.
Yeah,
it kind of swings her reason towards him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of an interesting thing to have, but yeah, may not have been totally necessary.
I mean, Ark is sort of the audience surrogate in trying to understand the backstory of the show.
Oh, that's true.
Like, he's sort of the route by which most of the exposition, especially the Gunbard, like, kind of stuff comes out.
That is true, because he's doing a lot of looking into this whole thing to try and piece it all together for reasons unrelated to the tiara itself, it turns out. It does lend a certain degree of background, and as we said with... as I mentioned earlier, with Gunbard, some gravitas to the whole affair. But overall, he's kind of more of a plot device than a lot of the other characters. And he doesn't really hurt the show, but it would have been interesting to either see him be more involved or not necessarily include him at all. I wonder what the show would have been like without him.
Yeah, I do give them credit, though, for, like, there's this whole thing between she wants to meet the prince, but she kind of likes Ark. Thank goodness they're the same person, all right? We don't have a love triangle in addition to all this other stuff.
That's, if you think that's a spoiler, by the way, by the time you get to the episode with Ark, it's pretty obvious.
The guy, the hair is so obvious, don't even worry about it.
This giant chocobo-looking thing that splays out to the side.
It has a huge, huge head of hair.
Yeah, it does, and it sticks out at the traditional... Japanese, this don't make sense at all, even with hair gel angles. Yes.
Actually,
like cloud strife kind of nonsense going in.
Right.
Funnily enough, that I wanted to point out, this is just a silly side thing that I noticed, but you see, for example, like all of the girls, you know, they all have different hairstyles to help make them immediately identifiable, as you know, as is standard anime practice.
Although, but more than just a color shift, thank goodness.
More than just a color shift, certainly. But their hair is actually drawn consistently. This, like we said, most of the animation is passable, but the characters staying on model, you see it way more than you do in a lot of shows where they take a lot of, you know, they take a lot of shortcuts, like seeing people's eyes through their hair, or at this angle the hair will look like this, but at this angle the hair will look like that. They actually took the time to consider, like Yusi, for example, has this one little bang that comes off. Otherwise, you know, fairly straight back hair that comes down her back. She's got this one bang, but rather than just, you know, having this thing kind of teleport to whatever angle is most visually appealing, they actually path out how this thing will move when she's turning her head, when she's changing position. And it's a stupid little detail, but it's just like, these are professionals. These are people who actually care enough about something that simple to give it that kind of care. I appreciate that. It goes to show again that whatever else you might think of Gainax from an animation standpoint, even when they're not giving it, like, the crazy treatment, like in the Gainax episode, they're being pros about it. They're being very professional.
I'd like to think there's a guy who in the credits has, like, UC's hair wrangler as a job.
Something like that.
Thank you, everyone. That was Dan's Artist Corner, starring Dan.
Thank you for indulging my tangent.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Actually, the bang reminded me of something while on the rewatch. Did you guys adore those cute little eye catches as much as I did?
The eye catches
of a show, in case people don't know, are at the midway point of an episode, they will have a screen or something that pops up almost as though there was supposed to be a commercial break. And it comes on for maybe a few seconds and then goes away, and you're back into the next half of the episode. Yeah, probably a few seconds.
It is where the commercial break would normally be inserted halfway through.
Right. So instead, they stick a picture or a little scene or something like that, or scantily clad women, whatever.
Sometimes.
And so this one, they have every character as in a little chibi, almost like chalk or Daniel
pastel, I think, yeah.
Pastel coloring, and they're doing something. And in one of them, actually, Yusi is like at a mirror desperately playing with her bang, and then it finally goes sproing, and it pops up the way her character has it, and she turns around and she goes, "My bang is ready, let's go." And I'm like, yes. Very, very yes. I think one of them, Balazan, like, on his chest, there's a little, what looks like wireless signal, and then in the end it taps out, and he just goes to sleep, and he's like, I'm out of network, and you're like, that's so cute. I think it's actually his episode where he goes out of network. That's like the Steward's episode, where they all, like, go inside of him to help whatever problem he's having.
There is a whole Stewards episode. Yes, the Stewards do get an entire episode to themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
The main characters on screen. So that was an interesting one, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. But those eye catches are so cute. And, you know, normally you're, I wouldn't say irritated by them, but you're like, ugh, all right, can we move on? And these are adorable. I loved every single one of those eye catches.
Mm. Yeah, because everyone's different, which is pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Huh.
Now,
that, I guess
there is one other thing, a little bit of background on this. Now, the show doesn't just kind of pop up out of nowhere. It isn't totally an original work. It's actually based on a line of games. Brendan, I think you and Scott both know a little bit more about that than the rest of us.
I doubt that.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, at one point, like, I guess it's the Princess Maker line of games, which is made by Gainax, so, like, that's kind of where it's coming from.
Mm.
And there's, I think it's, like, a set of two or three, maybe even more at this point. But this one appears to be most directly based off of, I think, Princess Maker 2 or 3. There aren't games that really ever made it over to the States. I think, like, one of them might have or something, like, two or something. But, I don't know, like, it was basically one of those games where you're bringing up a princess and you have to manage her stats and figure out if she's going to be a cutesy etiquette type or a fighter or whatever, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you're basically her father or guardian and, you know, helping to guide her development in the hopes that, you know, she will become the real deal. Actually, this is very similar to Brendan. This past year you were talking all about graduation and whatnot in your panel. It's a similar type of thing, right?
It is a little bit similar. It's more similar to a game by Headroom that didn't get turned into an anime called Mercurius Pretty, where you bring up a homunculus in the same fashion.
A what now?
Huh?
Okay, maybe we don't want to go down this rabbit hole right now, but we'll think about
that
for later.
Yeah, suffice to say, that's kind of where it's coming from, and it's an interesting, you know, place to approach it from. So I get the feeling that the guy who made the games, like the guy at Gainax who's in charge of those, is probably a big part of the team who made this anime. And that's why it has a pretty different flavor from a lot of Gainax stuff, but right. I'm glad it got made.
So you had mentioned being a dad or father figure to these characters in this game. I want to kind of touch upon the power of dads, which happens at the end. I mean, we did mention that every girl is exploring the relationship with her father, but I don't think this really gets enough credit. Very few anime has parents in general, and even less of those anime have father figures, and then even less of those father figures are good father figures.
Well, ain't that the truth?
You know, it's quite tragic. And the fathers in this show, every single one of them, are adorable in their own way, minus you, heaven father, but yeah, everybody else is really great. And you know what? That father is realistic too. He's the father with completely unrealistic expectations, and there are these few and far between moments that he smiles for her. I think in one episode, gosh, that was really sad, they go to help out at this rich guy's house who, he has a troubled relationship with his daughter, and she ran away from home and wrote him this note that he never opens. And Elmina sees herself in this girl and her father in this father. And she's like, no, I am sure that all she wanted was for you to understand her. And in the end, he has her read him the note the daughter left, and she starts crying, and he smiles for her, which it's almost like her living through that father, remembering this, the one and only, I think, smile she ever got from her dad. It's really touching, and
yeah.
I think the relationship with the dads all across the board was nice to see. So props to Yuzi for letting that happen.
Definitely. Like, and I think that even like prompted Elmina to write her own father a letter, like with the lessons she'd learned that day. So it's a good episode.
Yeah. Right, and the dads really saved the day at the end.
Mm. It's only through them that they're able to, you know, basically kick off the finale.
Yeah, successfully conclude the plot, which we're not really going to do too much more on.
Right. All right, so we're coming to the end, guys. I think we've talked about how much we really like this show. There's very few things to dislike in this show. I mean, you may not come out of it like, oh yeah, this was the best thing I've ever watched, but it's nonstop fun, I think, is really the way I'd put it. Some episodes are better than others, and no matter what filler is going on, you're always kind of smiling through it.
Right, because the strength of the character interactions is so good that it carries the show no matter what the filler of the day might be.
Very true. As you said very early on, Scott, it's simply charming. It's lighthearted. It never gets so heavy that it depresses you. Though it does have its sad moments for sure, it almost always ends on a positive note. And it's also never so saccharine that you think, okay, tone it down, guys. It's just it's very well balanced, gives a lot of, you know, a lot of positive characters, a lot of interesting interactions, and it does everything it does competently or very well.
Yeah. So
agreed.
Good note to end on. Everyone, you should watch this show.
Absolutely.
Light, this is the one for you.
Yes, some romantic comedy, a little bit of action, a whole lot of fun. Definitely check this out. So thanks for listening, guys. We'll be back next time, and you can bet we'll have elegant beauty and fantastic magic.